Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media.
Welcome to Earth Eats, a show of real food and green living. I'm Annie Corrigan.
As far as vegetables go, I'm putting in a lot of perennial things like Jerusalem artichokes and asparagus. Those are things that will come back every year, so I don't have to, you know, worry about them as much.
Daniel Orr is trying to set his garden up for success. In the kitchen with him, salad for breakfast? Definitely, especially when you're featuring eggs, cheese, and some fresh-from-the-garden greens. We then follow a beekeeper as he buys some new bees to put in his backyard hive. And from Harvest Public Media, last year, the federal government made a plan to address antibiotic resistance. Critics say one problem with the plan is it doesn't set goals to reduce antibiotics used to treat farm animals. Several stories to get to today with Mark Chilla.
The U.S. House approved a global food assistance program on a vote of 370-33. The bill is part of President Barack Obama's five-year Feed the Future initiative. The measure would allow $1 billion in funding for food security programs in developing countries. Lawmakers from big agricultural states threw their support behind the bill after language was added to protect current food aid programs included in the Farm Bill. Programs like Food for Peace support domestic farms by sending food grown in the U.S. to countries in crisis. The Senate will soon consider a companion version of the bill. Right now, millions of monarch butterflies are making their way back to the U.S. after a warm winter in Mexico. But 20 years from now, there may be no monarch butterflies left to migrate. That's according to new research by the Scripps Institution of Oceanography and the U.S. Geological Survey. The study says the migratory population of the eastern monarch butterfly has declined by about 80% in the last decade and has a significant chance of quasi-extinction in the next two decades, which means population numbers so low they can't recover. Adult monarchs lay eggs on milkweed plants, on which monarch larvae exclusively feed and live. But milkweed is also quietly creeping towards extinction. One 2012 study says there has been a 58% decline in milkweed in the Midwest from 1999 to 2010. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service last year announced plans to build a butterfly highway lined with milkweed and other habitat plants. And Aqua Bounty wants to expand its genetically modified salmon operation to a 38-year-old fish hatchery at Bay Fortune in Prince Edward Island. The initial request was denied due to concerns about the availability of groundwater and the amount of electricity needed. Environmental officials say no genetically modified production will happen at the new Rollo Bay West location. Instead, Aqua Bounty wants to use the former hatchery to raise 13,000 conventional salmon to provide eggs to be transferred to its Bay Fortune plant. The public comment period on Aqua Bounty's proposal ends April 15th, and officials expect a decision about the project could be made as early as April 22nd. In the fall of 2015, the FDA approved the sale of Aqua Advantage salmon in the U.S. It was the first time a genetically engineered animal had been approved for human consumption. A list of links to these stories is part of the podcast post at eartheats.org, and find us on Twitter for even more food news at Earth Eats.
That's right. Chad Bouchard and Taylor Killo do the blogging. Mark Chilla is the voice. Thanks for the update.
My pleasure.
Some of the most important medicines doctors prescribe to fight infections are losing effectiveness. Bacteria are building resistance to our antibiotics, and the White House is calling on doctors and farmers to help turn the tide. As Harvest Public Media's Grant Gerlach tells us, a recent report looks at how quickly the plan is making progress.
Antibiotics are part of many livestock feeding operations. They're often used to treat sick animals. But some farmers also put antibiotics in feed or water to keep animals from getting sick or to make them gain weight faster. One problem is not all those drugs stay on the farm.
Not all the antibiotics will be absorbed by the animal.
That's environmental engineer Zhu Li at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln. He measures antibiotic resistance in farm fields where livestock manure is spread as fertilizer.
So a certain part of it will be released into the environment.
The bacteria the medicines don't kill develop resistance to these drugs. Li's research shows those resistant bacteria can build up.
But recently people also find if an environment receives livestock manure from facilities that has been using antibiotics, then the level of antibiotics and antibiotic resistance genes in the soil environment will increase.
And that's a potential risk for public health. Not all bacteria are a direct risk to people, but can resistance spread to pathogens that are a threat? Last year, the White House released a national plan to get a handle on antibiotic resistance and created a presidential advisory council to follow its progress. In March, those experts got together in Washington to give an update on how the plan is working at hospitals and on the farm. Mike Apley is on the presidential council and also teaches at the vet school at Kansas State University. He told the council antibiotic resistance is not a new issue for farmers.
Judicious use guidelines have been being initiated by producers and veterinary groups in association with federal agencies for quite some time.
But federal agencies are changing some of the rules for how antibiotics are used on farms in an effort to cut down on their use. The FDA is asking pharmaceutical companies to stop allowing their antibiotics to be used just to make animals grow faster. The agency also set a new veterinary feed directive, or VFD. It means, in many cases, antibiotics that were sold over the counter now must be prescribed by a vet. Apley says the new rules are raising questions in the livestock industry about when antibiotics are really necessary.
So the VFD has been a real instigator of having those conversations about when should we, how should we, etc.
But some public health advocates are calling on the council and federal agencies to do more to enforce changes in antibiotic use, particularly on the farm. David Wallinga is a physician with the Natural Resources Defense Council. He says the FDA should set benchmarks to reduce antibiotic use at places like feedlots and hog barns.
Turns out they have set targets on the human side. They've said that we want to reduce the use of antibiotics in clinics by 50%, and we want to reduce the use of antibiotics in hospitals by 20%.
The FDA has not set targets for agriculture, he says, even though most of the antibiotics important for human health are used to treat animals, not people. Even now, under new guidelines, many drugs can still be fed to healthy animals to keep them from getting sick.
So it's really unclear to us that if you just get rid of the growth promotion on the label, that you're really going to change the way people use these antibiotics.
Even if the FDA did set targets for agriculture to use fewer antibiotics, it would be hard to tell if it was working. There is no system for collecting data on how farmers use antibiotics, and the Presidential Council says that is a problem. Here's Elizabeth Youngman of the Pew Charitable Trust, who led the council's working group on that issue.
I mean, I think there is quite a bit of recognition that without baseline data, it's going to be very difficult to monitor progress. That said, you know, the growth promotion changes happen this year, veterinary feed directive happens this year, the surveillance systems weren't funded.
The council is asking Congress to provide funding to the FDA and Department of Agriculture to create monitoring programs. Until then, it will be hard to know exactly what changes are happening on the farm and what it might mean for our health. Grant Gerlach, Harvest Public Media.
This week that Ortho will stop using neonicotinoids in their home and garden products. Neonics, as they're called, are a class of pesticides linked to the decline of pollinators. Good news for bees, but there are still reasons that colonies of bees die. Perhaps winter weather was especially harsh. Perhaps the hive was overtaken by mites. Luckily, though, for beekeeper Mike Bennett, his two backyard hives from last year are still going strong. He wanted to expand to a third hive this season. So we asked him to show us how he brings new bees to their new backyard home.
A lot of people think I get these bees out in the forest from a wild swarm, but actually in the past I've had to order bees through the mail. They arrive at the post office calls you, you come pick them up, and when you get there, the postal workers are quite scared of these buzzing packages. This time, I decided to go through a local bee supplier here in Indiana, in Martinsville, Hunter's Honey Farm.
Okay. It's a 3-pound package. Each package contains approximately 9,000 bees. And then there's also one queen in a cage waiting to be released. My name is Tracy Hunter, and I am the manager of Hunter's Honey Farm. These bees came from Georgia because in the South, they can get the bees going earlier. Whereas if we were raising the packages in Indiana, it wouldn't be until May. So the beekeeper then is going to take those bees back to his hive. It could be either a brand new one or it could be one that died over the winter, but it's going to be empty of any other bees. And he's going to shake those bees into his hive. The queen is in that cage. She is contained in there by a cork. Under the cork is candy, and he will drill a hole through that candy, place the queen cage in the new hive with the new bees, and then all of the workers wanting that queen to get out so that she can start laying eggs will chew through that candy. And as they're chewing through the candy, it takes time, so then they're feeding her through the screen wire, they're grooming her, they're getting to know her, her pheromones are becoming known to them, and then when she emerges through that queen cage, then they accept her and she'll start laying eggs. And so he is now, or she is, a beekeeper.
Hunter's Honey Farm said 24 hours they should be put into the hive. I'm gonna get them in the hive right away, if for no other reason than to make sure the queen is alive and well. I want to open this package up and make sure she's alive. Otherwise, the colony is totally doomed. Without the queen, and no comb, and no brood, and no ability to make a new queen, every bee in this hive is dead. This is a beautiful hive. It's a top bar hive. Right now I am building a feeding mechanism for the bees. I'm preparing the hive so that the bees will be able to go through the divider and drink some of this tasty sugar syrup. And I gotta drill a hole, and then we'll be good to go, ready to go. Now you'll notice that the bees will only have one entrance right now. But I'm going to further reduce the circumference of that entrance because I want the very limited guard bees that are in this really small colony right now, they'll have less work to do because there's less area to cover to keep out the bad guys, which are wasps, yellow jackets, other honeybees that simply want to come in and rob. These solid ones are going to close off the other two holes completely so that nothing can get in or out there, including our own bees. The long in this hive, we don't want them going in and out that way. We want them staying in this area so they can start to build comb. See her in there? She's a little small, and she's alive. Yeah, this is a part you may want to back up. I'm going to dump them in. They will hopefully follow their queen that they have hopefully accepted. You know, there's 9,000 inside, so that's enough to start drawing comb, and you know, it's the time of year where they're going to start their foraging and doing their bee business.
A special thanks to Yael Cassander for this story. More beekeeper profiles at eartheats.org. Coming up, the benefits of good bacteria.
Maybe it's able to outcompete a bad bacteria for attachment in the gastrointestinal tract and the intestine, so that would be a good thing.
And it's not just in our guts, but the guts of farm animals, too. Harvest with the story. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Charles Schwab and Company Incorporated, now with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. Earth Eats. I'm Annie Corrigan. Zachary Eve is staring down at a pot of simmering water. Sort of looks like he's meditating to the slowly swirling current in the pot. At Farm Bloomington, he's the guy in the kitchen in charge of poaching eggs. He added a couple tablespoons of white vinegar in there, a pinch of salt. He cracks an egg and gently, slowly drops it into the liquid, where it's picked up by the current. The white is rolling over itself.
Slightly firm. The key that I've learned is just to have enough vinegar in there. And you'll notice as soon as you throw it in there, the whites just kind of wrap around the yolk and forms a nice little ball. And over time, it gets whiter, whiter, whiter. Stays liquid on the inside. You get a nice, perfect poacher.
Zach is doing some vital prep work for the weekend to come at the restaurant. Yes, you can poach eggs a couple days ahead, store them in water in the fridge, and then revive them with warm water right before serving.
I like to do a box to a box and a half. If we're busy, probably about a box and a half 3 days out of the week. It's about 12 dozen. And then we use burn them up all weekend. Poutines. We have a very good Eggs Benedict. So.
Oh my gosh, all those eggshells.
And those go out to the compost, so you can see that we keep all of our green waste. And I've got this kind of little valley that I put all the compost in and cover it with leaves. And then as it rains, all those nutrients filter down and go into my mushroom garden.
Daniel Orr is our chef, but he's also an avid gardener. That mushroom patch is at his cabin, about 10 minutes outside of town. His mom's house in Columbus, Indiana, has a massive and gorgeous front yard garden. And then there's his family's Kolb homestead in Gibson County. The shiitakes were great last year, he says, and he's hoping for more of the same. And he's also expecting the first harvest from his cherry and pear trees this season.
But as far as vegetables go, I'm putting in a lot of perennial things like Jerusalem artichokes and asparagus and rhubarb and things like that. So those are things that will come back every year, so I don't have to, you know, worry about them as much because I'm traveling a lot. So that gives me a break, and I know that I'll get some goodies out of the garden.
These two recipes are very garden-forward, if you will, and especially great if you're enjoying an early harvest of greens.
All right, gardener's breakfast. I like to use the romaine leaves. They're almost like little taco cups. You could use Napa cabbage leaves, and I just kind of lay those down on the plate, you know, four or five. Then we're going to kind of build the layers on this. So I'm going to sprinkle it with some ricotta cheese, which is going to give us that creaminess. Then I'm going to put some tomatoes. Now, my grandmother's favorite breakfast during tomato season was just sliced tomatoes and eggs for breakfast. So this is kind of in honor of Grandma Kolb. So I'm just going to lay those on the lettuce leaves. Then I'm going to sprinkle some baby arugula on top of that. And then drizzle it just with a simple dressing. We're going to just do some olive oil, sea salt, some freshly ground pepper. We grind our pepper every day here at the restaurant. And then we're going to top it with some torn herbs. I've got some basil from Good Life Farms. Okay, and then we're going to do some poached eggs. Now these, you could serve them either warm or cold. And those look really nice on top. They almost look like some fresh mozzarella. With the eggs, I'm always going to finish them with a little bit of salt and pepper. And then finally, for the acidic part of the dressing, we're just going to squeeze some fresh lemon juice on top of there. Okay, and that's a really nice, very light, healthy breakfast for either before or after you get out of the garden.
Sorry that it's not quite tomato season yet. Keep this recipe in your back pocket for a couple months from now when the cherry tomatoes will start to appear. Now, this other salad features some darlings of spring. We're in Daniel's mom's kitchen in Columbus for this one. I mentioned her massive front yard garden. Daniel went outside and plucked these ingredients from the ground right then and there.
Asparagus. All right, let's get the water boiling. We're going to just use those few ingredients that we pulled up today. I've got about 6 or 8 beautiful little new potatoes. Cut these into some little pieces. Got some of those nice lettuces out of the garden. In this case, we're using some of the mezclan that we had, which has some red oak leaf, some green oak leaf, a little bit of Lola Rosa. Then we've got these fun, great big, little bit overgrown asparagus. And we're going to snap those just into pieces. And you kind of, when they stop snapping easy, that means they're too tough to eat. We're using a little bit of olive oil in a nonstick pan. And we're going to cook some of these great eggs. What I'm going to do is just cover them with a plate. And what that's going to do is allow them to cook very gently and kind of be sheared eggs. At the same time, I've got my potatoes cooking over here, some salted water. I'm going to just leave those really, really simple. And with the asparagus, right in that same water with the potatoes, turn off our eggs. Right on top of the lettuce, kind of wilting it. Okay, and we're just going to drizzle a little good extra virgin olive oil, and a little bit of your favorite vinegar.
Couple slices of crusty bread and a heaping ball of goat cheese round out this salad. Without a doubt, one of my favorite Chef D recipes. Just so simple. EarthEats.org to find more salad inspiration. Another story from Harvest Public Media about antibiotics losing their effectiveness. Scientists say giving the drugs to farm animals is part of the problem. That's why researchers are looking into new ways to keep livestock healthy and profitable, especially the animals that become our steak and pork chops. As Amy Mayer reports, they're turning to something you can probably find in your fridge.
I'm going to go down.
What pen are you going to first?
I'm going clear down.
Kelly Nissen is feeding the cows at the Iowa State University Beef Nutrition Farm. Far from just tossing hay, he's delivering specific rations to numbered feed bunks.
When you're feeding, you're always double-checking yourself to make sure it's going into the right lot.
These cows are munching on the common mix of grass and grain, but they're often getting a little something new, too. They test different formulas that researchers in the Animal Science Department at Iowa State develop. Researchers like Stephanie Hansen.
There are alternatives to antibiotics in feed, and that's going to be a broad area of research here in the next 10 to 15 years.
One alternative may sound familiar. Ever read the ingredients on a cup of creamy chobani? A good yogurt will contain several live bacteria, which can help you stay healthy by keeping your gut happy. no one's going to feed pigs, chickens, or cows Yoplait. But researchers are looking at a bacterium commonly found in your lunchbox, Lactobacillus acidophilus.
Acidophilus would have the same impact in a production livestock animal as it would in humans.
Hansen says a beneficial bacterium can help ward off harmful ones.
Maybe it's able to outcompete a bad bacteria for attachment in the gastrointestinal tract and the intestine, so that would be a good thing.
And if it prevents the bad bacteria from making animals sick, farmers will need fewer antibiotics. The U.S. Department of Agriculture's data suggest nearly half of chickens and about 40% of pigs may get antibiotics when they're not even sick, though overall use has declined in recent years. With veterinarians and livestock producers both now looking for other ways to bring healthy animals to market size, nutrition companies are paying attention. Iowa-based Diamond V has developed a pig feed supplement made from Lactobacillus acidophilus. Jason Frank says they got the idea from work on human nutrition.
We've seen improvements in weight gain, feed conversion, and feed intake in young pigs. But more interestingly, we've seen that by improving general health and performance, that those pigs are requiring fewer injectable treatments.
That's what they're looking for, less need to treat with antibiotics. Because the more we reduce antibiotic use on the farm, the less likely bacteria are to adapt and become resistant to our medicines. It's a short path from use in the barn to preserving effectiveness in the hospital. Last year, the Obama administration announced a plan aimed at cutting down reliance on these medicines. Frank says that's boosted interest.
As antibiotics become more limited on their use, one, we're going to have to make changes in how we raise animals, perhaps develop more vaccines, change our stocking densities, nutrition programs. But part of that transition to new production styles is looking at these products that can improve health.
Poultry researcher Alejandro Penalosa at Oklahoma State University has found a helpful bacteria that can survive in poultry feed. He says some large chicken producers are interested in it because it helps the birds gain weight with less feed. That's a benefit they used to get from antibiotics. Penalosa says his probiotic could be a good replacement.
We cannot say that probiotics is the silver bullet to completely eliminate antibiotics, but I am sure that they can help a lot.
Because just like many people, animals might be even healthier with some changes to their diets. And as human nutrition explores new possibilities, the animal researchers will be paying attention. There's plenty of overlap. Here's Stephanie Hansen again.
There are essential oils. There are enzymes that could be supplemented. There could be a possibility that trace minerals and vitamins could play positive roles.
Moving beyond antibiotics on the farm will be a gradual process, but it is underway, getting a little inspiration from our diet trends. Amy Mayer, Harvest Public Media.
Let me direct you to the website where Amy and Grant and all the Harvest reporters post their stories. It's harvestpublicmedia.org. Daniel Orr is a busy man at Farm Bloomington Restaurant. Thanks to him for all the recipes. Thanks also to Aabon Binder, Mark Chilla, and Betsy Shepherd for keeping EarthEats.org in order. And Chad Bouchard and Taylor Killow write for the blog. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Charles Schwab & Company Incorporated, now with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media. Will Murphy, executive producer. Listeners like you make the Earth Eats community strong, and we appreciate your support. Have a wonderful day. I'm Annie Corrigan.